go do a sick one.
Okay.
It's almost done.
Psalm 87, a psalm of the sons of Korah, a song. His foundation is in the holy mountains. The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things of you are spoken, O city of God. I will make mention of Rahab and Babylon to those who know me. Behold, O Philistia and Tyre with Ethiopia, this one was born there. And of Zion it will be said, this one and that one were born in her, and the Most High himself shall establish her. The Lord will record when he registers the peoples, this one was born there. Selah. Both the singers and the players on instruments say, all my springs are in you. Amen.
Amen. Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. Greetings on this sixth day of the fifth month, which is, today is August 2nd. You may recall back in 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait. Then on the 16th of January came Operation Desert Storm, January of 1991. The world, has been a different place in many ways since that period. Cold War ended and a new kind of war began, and the focus of attention of the world to a large degree shifted to the Middle East, where it remains even as we speak, a very turbulent region, and it's hard to avoid talking about it. And of course, if you're interested in the Bible does have a lot to say about that part of the world. But we're grateful that you're listening today, and we hope and pray that you're having a peaceful Sabbath where you are, and that you're enjoying the respite, the rest, the break, the change of pace. And we are grateful for your interest in this ministry and that you're wanting to listen to what is being said here. I want to give you some advice, some financial advice. If you have to borrow money, borrow from a pessimist. He doesn't expect to get it back. Thought you might enjoy that. These are difficult times economically for many of us too. And on a more serious note, we need to be praying for one another at this time, you know, and with financial turbulence going on in the world and potential for more. And also, you know, health issues come up in the community, and I'm going to say more about that after I finish this talk. This is a serious time of the year, and it calls for a serious message, but a positive one, of course, because God's truth is positive. We know ultimately things are going to work out. God has a plan, and the plan is inevitably going to be fulfilled, and good will ultimately triumph. But we have many difficult challenges between this time and whenever that time is going to be. And this time of year reminds us that when God's people have violated their relationship with him, their commitments to him, they have unfortunately been punished. And over the centuries, this has been the case. Beginning with tomorrow, the seventh day of the fifth month, and going into the tenth day, that period of time has been a period of immense calamity over the centuries. Many tragic events have occurred. And the focus, in terms of observance, is on the ninth day of the fifth month. For a couple of millennia, the observance has been, and if not earlier, on the ninth day of the fifth month, a fast and a reading of the book of Lamentations. But before Lamentations is read, and that will be Tuesday of this coming week, Monday night, we'll begin it. Many Jews will be reading the book of Lamentations Monday night and Tuesday. But before that, Isaiah number 1 is read. And you can look at that today if you'd care to. And it talks about why these calamities come. is because people unfortunately engage in self-destructive behavior. Isaiah, the first chapter, pretty much outlines the difficulties that have occurred, and sin is self-destructive. When you talk about history, human history, we have empires that come together and become powerful and wealthy. They rise, but then they fall. And the rise and fall of empires, to a degree, is due to the fact that societies tend to become corrupted. And as I said, sin is self-destructive. Finally, as you know, a great empire will arise in the end times, and it too will be tremendously corrupt, and it too will fall. And that will be, in effect, the final curtain, the final closing of this phase of history. I want to go then to the end of the story. Revelation 18, it's introduced my talk today. My talk today goes all the way back to about 1380 BC, or BCE, if some of you want to call it that. 1380 BC is where I'm going to mainly be today. But yet, what I'm going to say is very applicable to now and the future. But first, let's go to the future. Revelation 18. And after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried, verse 2, mightily, with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, unless you receive of her plagues. That's certainly the message of the church, to come out of the general culture and civilization around us. And, of course, what we share, the values that we share that are positive, of course, are fine. We share them. But that which is not positive, we must avoid, and we must do better. I talked about that last week. We're not perfect, but, you know, we're trying. As some of the bumper stickers you may see on the highways, you know, Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven. But more than that, we're not just forgiven. We're also trying to remain in a state of a right relationship with our Creator. So we're to come out of her, this false civilization, this corrupt civilization. Verse 5, for her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. So yes, eventually the piper must be paid, you know. Eventually, we do come to a climax, and these corrupt societies collapse. You know, they do self-destruct. This is true in the Gentile world, as we read here, and it's true, of course, among Israelites. It's true in the church. Church eras have come and gone, and unfortunately, a lot of that has to do with problems, internal problems within each of those eras. But I want to go particularly talking about Israel to Matthew 24. Jesus, a Jew, came to his people, and he saw Jerusalem, which is someday to be the capital of the world, as you heard in the opening prayer. In the opening prayer, you heard how Jerusalem, Zion, people will come from all over the world, and yet they'll be considered as if they were born there, because we'll be like, in that sense, one people spiritually. We will be the Israel of God, and Jerusalem will be the capital of the world. And in a sense, Zion, the physical Zion, is a type spiritually of the church, the New Jerusalem, which is the mother of us all. But I want to go to Matthew 24 and verse 37 and hear Jesus Christ before his arrest on Passover of 31 AD, just before he comes and says in verse 37 of Matthew 24. I'm sorry, Matthew 23, I apologize. Let's go one chapter back. Matthew 23, 37. Oh, Jerusalem, he says, Matthew 23, 37. Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. So he looked ahead 40 years to the destruction of Jerusalem and all those centuries when his people would be suffering all through the centuries, scattered as an exile, as a people in a diaspora. Verse 39, for I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Psalm 118, verse 26, until you tell me, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Eternal, which they will say when he returns. When their backs are to the wall and Jerusalem is under siege, They will look to the Messiah. The Messiah will come. They'll have to admit, however, that he had come before and was rejected by their establishment. And they will have to tell him, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, as you read in Zechariah 12, Zechariah 14. Now, they did say that then, briefly. You know, they said it when he first came. But then when he didn't deliver them then, when he allowed himself to be arrested, they then turned on him and became hostile, and even many called for him to be crucified. And crucifixion is, it's not just a matter of executing, but to ask that he be crucified. What a horrible, horrific, hideous way to die. And yet many were calling for that. Very, very sad. So he said to Jerusalem, the climax is coming for you. Your corruption is going to bear fruit, and you will self-destruct in a generation. And so this is what I'm saying, that nations, if they are, nations are accountable, civilizations are accountable. And this is really the lesson of this season of the year, that civilizations do not go on forever. They are young, they rise, they fall, and sin is self-destructive. And nations, like individuals, age, and finally, you know, as individuals finally die, so do civilizations. I'd like to go to Proverbs, the 14th chapter. Proverbs 14 and verse 34. This is a very important principle of wisdom. Proverbs 14:34. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Nations have a responsibility to behave ethically as much as possible. And when nations behave unethically, you know, no matter who they are, no matter what their background, it's a reproach to them. And as I said, it is self-destructive. Well, keeping that in mind, today I want to talk about a great hero of the Bible, and he does tie into this season of the year. I always try to give, as you know, spiritual food in due season. And this is the season of the year, which is midsummer, and this is the fifth month, and this is the time of lamentations and of very sobering events that occurred in history. And according to Jewish tradition, it all began back in the book of Numbers. It began when two heroic spies said, "We can do it! God will see us through. He saw us through until now. He plagued the Egyptians. He was with us at the Red Sea." Two great heroic spies, the two witnesses of that time. But there were 10 who opposed them and said, "Well, it's a wonderful land, all right, but we can't succeed. We'll fail. We'll lose," and disheartened the people. You know the story. So let's go to Numbers. I want to go to the 13th chapter of Numbers. Actually, the 14th chapter, in beginning of the 14th chapter. "So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night." Well, that season of the year was the beginning of the grape harvest, we're told in Numbers 13. They wept that night, and the Jewish tradition is that night was the ninth of Av. And that's when it was decided that they would have to wander in the desert for 40 years. Well, whether or not it's true, it was around that season of the year anyway. And as I said, there were heroes that stood out at that time. Two great heroes, Joshua and Caleb. And one of them became particularly significant as really the second in command, the assistant to Moses. Today I'm going to talk about Joshua's legacy. The title of this talk is Joshua's legacy, because Joshua, before he died, gathered the people together and gave a farewell address, and then also had a special ceremony with them, which I'm going to talk about today. First, I want to go to Exodus, the 17th chapter. Now, some of you may know Joshua from Hollywood, you know. Maybe some of you remember Charlton Heston and John Derrick. I think this was before he married the famous actress that he married later. I don't know if they're still married or if they're still alive. Charlton Heston is no longer alive. But they're, you know, those characters, you know, and I guess in many people's minds, Charlton Heston and John Derrick remain Moses and Joshua in their minds. But, Joshua would have been a small child when Moses fled Egypt. So they wouldn't have had a whole lot of, much of a relationship then. Now, of course, when Moses returned, Joshua was an adult, and then Joshua lived through the wilderness period and to the conquest of the land, and he died at the age of 110. But if you do the math, you'll find that he was probably born around 1490, so he would have been rather young when Moses fled Egypt. But anyway, he was an adult when Moses returned, and he did play an important role in the Exodus as an aid to Moses. And you'll see in Exodus 17, I want to go to verse 9. I'm in Exodus 17, 9. I'm talking now about Joshua, Yehoshua, because he's the hero of today's talk. You know, I'm talking about Joshua's legacy. Now, as an American, I did a paper as an American historian, let's say. I did a paper when I was in Brooklyn College on Joshua's farewell. Not on Joshua, no. That would have been interesting. I did a paper in American history on George Washington and his farewell address. And even though there are times when people try to sort of poo-poo that as just belonging to his own age, he intended it as advice that the nation would permanently treasure. And generally speaking, it has. It just depends on what side you're on. You know, in other words, whatever the foreign policy debate is, his letter is either dusted off or rejected as old-fashioned, depending on what position you take. You know what I'm saying? But his farewell address is something Americans study or should. They did when I was in school. And we're going to talk today about Joshua's farewell address, which he did intend to be remembered because it's in the canon, it's in the Bible. So I want to talk about Joshua here as a hero of the Exodus in verse 9. And Moses said to Joshua, Yehoshua, choose us some men and go out fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So you see Joshua's importance back in Exodus 17. But you know, his name was not originally Joshua. His name was Hoshea. Let's go to Numbers 13. Numbers 13, we find that the various leaders of the tribes were sent to spy out, or various delegates, probably courageous men and men of wisdom and renown, and also who had the energy and the physical prowess to do this. They were sent out to be spies, to look over the land and to come back with a report. Unfortunately, as you know, 10 of them were negative. Very, very sad. And they were punished for that. But if I want to go to verse 16 of Numbers 13. Now these are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, and Moses called Hoshea. So his name was Hoshea, which means salvation, but it could also mean save. Now why did his parents name him Save as a prayer? Well, they probably wanted to be delivered from Egyptian bondage, from Egyptian oppression. So they named him Hoshea. But Moses changed his name to a theophoric name. I'll use a technical term. A theophoric name. A name that has God's name in it. So he went from Hoshea to Yehoshua. The eternal is salvation. And Moses called Hoshea the son of Nun, Yehoshua, Joshua. The eternal is salvation. That's interesting. We have a savior by that name. Joshua is the name that was given to the savior, because Joshua means the eternal is salvation. Now later on, it began to be pronounced differently over time. I want to show you that briefly. I want to go to the book of Zechariah, the 3rd chapter. This is a little bit on the technical side, but I want my listeners to be highly educated. Okay, Zechariah 3, and this is the high priest at the time of the rebuilding of the second temple, the rebuilding of that temple, when the Jews returned from exile in in Babylonia under the Persians, they were able to come back. And the high priest was Joshua, but he had sinned evidently in some way and was being forgiven of that sin. And so in Zechariah 3, we see he's named. Now Joshua, this is Zechariah 3:3. Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and was standing before the angel. And this is capitalized, so the translators believe this is the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, the Logos, God as God the communicator, God as the Word. Then he answered and spoke to those who stood before him, saying, take away the filthy garments from him. And to him he said, see, I have removed your iniquity from you, and I will clothe you with rich robes, talking to Joshua, the high priest. But you know, later on, he's called Jeshua. The name is pronounced a little differently. So instead of Yehoshua, they're beginning to call him Yeshua or Yeshua. Let's notice that in the book of Ezra. I want to go to Ezra, the 5th chapter. This is a historical account, not quite in the same style as Zechariah prophecy. I'm now going to Ezra and fifth chapter. Then the prophet Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, the prophets prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. See, this is being written in Aramaic, so we're explaining things because this is intended for a Gentile audience to a degree. This part of the Bible is in Aramaic. So Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Josedech, okay, the civil leader and the high priest that you read about a moment ago, rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. So here we have Yeshua. So you see, it's another form of that name. And because it was pronounced Yeshua, that's why it came out in the Greek as it did, Jesus. And so we have the English name Jesus. Well, so Jesus is really a form of Joshua. And if you go to Hebrews 4:8 in the Old King James, possibly that's on your screen, but if not, many of you have Old King James Bible, so you can blow the dust off of your Old King James Bible and take a look at Hebrews 4:8. And you'll see that they're talking about Joshua. It uses the word Jesus there, talking about Joshua, because the Greek word Jesus is, the Americanized Greek word Jesus is a form of Joshua's name. So if you have that on the screen, fine. If not, you can look it up in the Old King James later. Now your New King James will say Joshua, because that's the intent. If you read Hebrews 4:8, it's obviously talking about Joshua. I want to go to Matthew 1 and verse 21. Matthew 1 and verse 21. Why was Jesus given that name? Why was he named, in effect, after Joshua, Moses' assistant? In Matthew 1, we have the answer. And verse 21, okay? And she will bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, or Yeshua, because by that time, Yehoshua was still used. But Yeshua was also a form that was used. And she will bring forth a son, and he may have been called Yehoshua in some areas and Yeshua in other areas. It may have depended upon what region he was in. I read recently that perhaps in Galilee he was Yehoshua, and in the south in Judah he was Yeshua. So it might have depended on, you know, whether you were a Yankee or a rebel. I'm kidding. You know, whether you were from the northern part of the country, the southern part of the country. And she will bring forth a son and will call his name Jesus. Why? That doesn't mean anything in Greek. You have to go back to the original meaning in the Hebrew and the Aramaic. For he will save his people from their sins. Oh, that's why he's called Yeshua, Yehoshua, the eternal salvation. For he shall save Israel from their sins. But Joshua was a type. Joshua led them into the promised land in the physical sense. Well, let's go to what Joshua told them after they had conquered the land, after the tribes had been given their various allotments, and he was about to die. So we're now about 1380 BC. Joshua is about to die, and just as Moses before his death had a lot to say, Joshua had a lot to say. And this is Joshua's legacy. And this is a message for all time. It's in the Bible for us. Now, this is in Joshua 23. Joshua 23. Now it came to pass a long time after the Eternal had given rest to Israel from all their enemies round about. So time had gone on, and I'm figuring about 20 years. I'm speculating. From all their enemies round about, that Joshua was old, advanced in age. As you know, he died at the age of 110. And Joshua called for all Israel, for their elders, for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers, and said to them, I am old, advanced in age. You have seen all that the Eternal your God has done to all these nations because of you. For the Eternal your God is he who has fought for you. You know, you've been through that experience. You have won. You have come in here in these advanced societies with their walled cities and their armaments and their military prowess. They were militaristic nations. They were bloodthirsty nations who delighted evidently in killing one another. And yet Israel defeated them. See, I have divided to you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes from the Jordan with all the nations that I have cut off as far as the great sea westward, all the way to the Mediterranean, from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. And of course, even on, as we understand, if you go to the chapter before, the east bank of the Jordan as well, up to the Euphrates River in theory. And the Eternal, your God, will expel them from before you and drive them out of your sight, so you shall possess their land, as the Eternal, your God, promised you. So there's more victories to come. Therefore, be very courageous to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left. So have the fortitude to do the right thing, to stick with it. It's not always the easiest thing. Stick with it. You made a commitment at Sinai. You made a covenant. You renewed it before you crossed the river. 40 years later, about whenever it was, you know, maybe about 30 years before when you crossed the Jordan, you renewed that covenant. And lest you go among these nations, lest you remain, lest who remain among you, you shall not make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them. You shall not serve them, nor bow down to them. So don't mix your religion with these other religions. And, you know, you don't, you've got a way of life. You've got a law, a code. You've got the Torah. You don't need to, fudge and mix it up, mess it up. Verse 8 of Joshua 23. But you shall hold fast to the Eternal your God as you have done to this day. You have to hold fast. You have to, you know, cling, cleave, you know, hang on. Because the pressures are there. There are two types of pressure. Sometimes the enticements, the allurements that seduce you, and sometimes the pressure of, you know, that wants to force you to change. There are those two types of pressure. Verse 9, for the Eternal has driven out from before you great and strong nations, but as for you, no one has been able to stand against you to this day. One man of you shall chase 1,000, for the Eternal your God is he who fights for you, as he promised you. Now, I'm not drinking everything out of these verses. I could spend time on various ones of them. But I have another chapter to deal with, so I'm going to go forward. Therefore, take careful heed to yourselves that you love the Eternal your God. Or else, if indeed you do go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go into them, and they to you. You know, if you mix with these pagans, these unethical people, who've done all kinds of hideous things, in terms of their lifestyle, perverse sexual practices, you can read Leviticus 18, the kind of sexual practices they engaged in, and the violence they engaged in. These are peoples who were at the very nadir, you know, the very bottom of the barrel from a moral point of view. You don't mix with such people. Know for certain that the Eternal your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Eternal your God has given you. If you become like them, you'll have the same fate, the same destiny. And that's unfortunately what did happen. They began to copy these practices, such as sacrificing their children, you know, to these idols and doing those sorts of things, loose sexual practices and so on, and oppressing each other financially and all the rest of it. And so they were, in fact, exiled from the land. And that's what these days coming up will remind us of if we take note, if we perhaps study the Isaiah 1 and the Book of Lamentations over the next number of days, it'll bring to mind that history. You would be very surprised if you studied history and saw what kinds of events happened between the 7th and 10th of Av. Right now we're observing the 100th anniversary of the First World War, which began at that time. The 9th of Av, back in 1914, was on August 1st. That is when Germany declared war on Russia. The next day, the 2nd, is when Jews were fasting. That was the 10th, because that year the 9th of Av was a Sabbath. The next day was the 10th, when they actually were fasting. That's when Germany invaded Luxembourg, and so the Western Front War began. Now it was, I think, on the 4th of August, UK declared war on Germany, and that, you know, will be commemorated in the UK coming up. Some of you are listening there, so you'll be having, as far as I understand, a very great man, and I should have checked who it was, But a very great man said at that time, the lights are going out all over Europe. They will not be, come on again in our lifetime. Some statement to that effect. I don't know who it was. Some of you want to look it up and tell me that are here in the room. But some great man said, the lights are going out all over Europe and they will not come on again in our lifetime. Well, the Brit, evidently in
England. Sir Edward Grey made it.
Sir Edward?
Grey.
Sir Edward Grey, G-R-E-Y, right? Sir Edward Grey. Okay. Thank you very much. Sir Edward Grey. And, I watch the British Prime Minister normally from week to week. I watch the, questions of the Prime Minister. This half an hour session where they have this, knockdown, drag out debate, between the, Labour Party, the Lib Dems and the Tories. I find it interesting to watch. Prime Minister Cameron made a comment that, in England they were gonna shut off their lights, to remember the First World War. Well, as I said, the First World War, a very interesting political commentator and amateur historian, Dick Morris, made a comment where he said the First World War really lasted 80 years. It didn't really end until 1991. If you really think about the First World War, it was really the beginning of the Holocaust. What happened in the First World War laid the groundwork 20 years later for the Second World War and for Nazism and communism and the various isms that came out of that war, fascism. And then communism continued its struggle with the Western world for another number of years, so that really it wasn't until the fall of the Soviet Union that the First World War ended, you might say, the various rounds, round one, round two, round three, right? The First World War, the Second World War, and the Cold War. So it really wasn't until 1991, 80 years or so later, that the World War I ended. It's kind of interesting. So anyway, that goes back to the season of the year and the various events that occurred. But as I said, why? The reason is sin. The reason why we have these kinds of problems is society behaves self-destructively. Unfortunately, people often behave self-destructively. And so he's warning them, don't be that way. You know better. You have instruction. You have Moses' instruction. You have my instruction. Behold this day, verse 14, I'm going the way of all the earth. As Ben Franklin said, there's only two things that are inevitable. One of them is taxes, but the other one is death. Behold, this day I'm going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one thing has failed of all the good things which the eternal God spoke concerning you. All have come to pass for you, not one word of them has failed. Therefore it shall come to pass that as all the good things have come upon you, which the eternal your God promised you, so the eternal will bring upon you all harmful things until he has destroyed you from the good land which the eternal your God has given you. Well, indeed, that happened. When you have transgressed the covenant of the eternal your God, which he commanded you, and have gone and served other gods and bowed down to them, and then the anger of the eternal will burn against you, and you shall perish quickly from the good land which he has given you. So we have a responsibility to remember the commitment that we made. Now, each of us, many of you who are listening to me now, made your own personal commitment. And that was at baptism. You have your own personal commitment that you made. You accepted upon yourself the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And you said, from here on out, I'm going to try to live as he would live, as he would have me to live. And you were given great assurances because of that. You received God's Spirit, many of you who are listening to me. And you received a power which is the earnest, the down payment on the resurrection. Many of you who are listening to me now are looking forward to living forever. You will die just quickly, and maybe, depends when your death occurs. But if Jesus returns before you die, your death will be very quick, and then you will instantly be resurrected. Or if you die before his return, it'll be like a sleep, because you'll be resurrected to spirit life when he returns. You made a commitment at baptism. Now, in ancient times, you had the people of Shem, the people of Ham, and the people of Japheth, and Shem had a son, Eber, E-B-E-R, and the root of that name in Hebrew has to do with crossing over. Evidently, the descendants of Eber crossed over the Euphrates River and went from Iraq to populate the area which is southwestern Asia, the Middle East, the bridge between Africa, Asia, and Europe, they crossed Euphrates to populate that region, and so in a loose sense became Hebrews. But more specifically, the term Hebrew came to be associated with Abraham. Abraham left behind the paganism of his day, became an ethical monotheist, and crossed the Euphrates River and headed ultimately for Canaan, the land that God said his descendants would ultimately inherit. And so he became Abram the Hebrew, because he crossed over the Euphrates River. This was a form of baptism. He left paganism behind, and he crossed the Euphrates and went to ultimately to Canaan. And if you look at Genesis 14 and verse 13, Abraham is called Abram Hivri. Genesis 14:13. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. So there was a war then. The Middle East has its wars continually. Here was another Mideast war back then, and somebody came and told Abram that Lot, his nephew, had been captured. But here he's called Abram the Hebrew. So he began to be called the Hebrew. And particularly, those who inherited the relationship with Yahweh, the God of the covenant, the God of the Bible, they became known as Hebrews. So Jacob, Isaac, and Jacob, and Jacob's sons became known as Hebrews. And so Hebrew became a synonym for Israelite. The Israelites were also called Hebrews. And a Hebrew came to be associated with a certain view of religion. That is to say, Hebrews worshiped the God of the Hebrew Bible. They worshiped Yahweh. And so Hebrew became a term that had a spiritual significance. I'd like to go to the book of Jonah. Jonah also had a type of baptism, as you can think of, right? He was down under the water and came back up. He was inside the great fish, a great sea creature, whatever it was, a great sea creature of some sort that had swallowed him. And so he was down in the water and came up. It was a baptism. And looking at Jonah, in Jonah 1 and verse 9, how does he identify himself? This is Jonah 1 verse 9. So he said to them, I am a Hebrew. Ivri Anohi. I am a Hebrew, and I fear Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, but he's also, frankly, everybody's God. Kind of reminds me of a movie that I saw. I know it's kind of silly to bring it up, but I like to have these pop culture references when I can do it. I saw a movie with Gene Wilder playing a Polish rabbi who somehow winds up out west among Native Americans, among Indians. And so they're talking to him about, I guess, about his God. And so Gene Wilder says to this Indian chief, he's your God also. There's only one God. But anyway, verse 9. So he said to them, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Eternal, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. So he was Jonah the Hebrew. Now I bring that up because of what Joshua says here in the 24th chapter. All right, we had Joshua's farewell address. We had his warning to the people. Stay with the covenant. Keep your commitment and you'll stay in the land and be blessed and you'll even become stronger. But if you fail, you will be expelled from the land. That was his farewell address. But now he gathers them together for a solemn renewal of the covenant while he's still alive. He brings them together in the city of Shechem. He brings them together there. Now, hopefully you'll see a map of the Middle East in a moment, and you'll see the Euphrates River. And so, as I said, the Israelites had come from across the Euphrates River. Abraham had crossed the river, a type of baptism when he was still Abram, before he became Abraham. And so he became Abram the Hebrew, the one who had come from the other side of the river. And his descendants became known as Hebrews, and that was also associated with the worship of the God of the Bible, Yahweh. And so Joshua reminds them of that. And so here Joshua gathers together the Hebrews of his day, the Israelites of his day, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the leaders of the 12 tribes, and he gathers them together in the city of Shechem. And that is today near the modern city that is called Nablus. It was called Neapolis, or New City. But in Arabic, the P and the B, they have trouble with the P sound in Arabic, so it comes out as Nablus. And that is the area now which the Bible calls Shechem. And to the north is Mount Ebal, and to the south is Mount Gerizim, two very important mountains in biblical history. And there's a well there, Jacob's well. Shechem is a very important place in the Bible. And in fact, if you go to Mount Ebal, you go to the top. I heard from a very wonderful man who's died recently, very wonderful, wise minister named David Wainwright. I heard from David Wainwright that Mount Ebal is just about the tallest mountain in that part of the land of Israel. And you can get on Mount Ebal and you can see a piece of all the land that was given to the various tribes. So if you go to Genesis 12, probably that's what Abram did. Probably in Genesis 12, he went to the top of Mount Ebal and God told him, you know, your descendants will inherit this land. And he was able from that point, about 3,000 feet, for those of you who speak English, what would that be, about, 900 meters, whatever, high. He could see all the various tribal inheritances, at least a piece of each one. Anyway, then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel, to Shechem, or Shechem, and called for the, elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, so here is a solemn ceremony. It's not just enough for me to give you a farewell address. I now want to seal it with a solemn ceremony where we recommit ourselves to this covenant in a special way while I'm still alive. I want you to do what you did for Moses before his death. And Joshua said to all the people, thus says the eternal God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river. If you look it up in the Hebrew, it's the same root word that gives you the word Hebrew, the other side of the river. Who dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. So by crossing the river, they also, in effect, left behind those gods. We hope. But did they? The problem is they didn't. That's what's so sad. That they didn't. They should have. Then I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him throughout all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his descendants, and gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. Now Esau, however, did not inherit the birthright. He has his land given to him in the area of what is today the southern part of the country of Jordan, around the area of Petra. Many of you have heard of that rose-red city of Petra. When I was younger, it was something that Bible thumpers, tambourine whackers were very well aware of. But then it became pop culture with the Indiana Jones movie. What was it called? The Holy Grail or whatever? Search for the Holy Grail, whatever it was called. The Last Crusade? That's what really was called? The Last Crusade? Okay. Anyway, in that movie, Petra was very prominent in that movie. And that was the area of ancient Edom. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau I gave the mountains of Seir to possess. But Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. You know the story. And I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt according to what I did among them. Afterward I brought you out. Then I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea. And the Egyptians pursued your fathers with chariots and horsemen to the Red Sea. So they cried out to the Eternal, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians, brought the sea upon them and covered them, and your eyes saw what I did in Egypt. Then you dwelt in the wilderness a long time. So he's reminding them of the recent history. And you yourselves could go back over ways God has bailed you out here and there, and how you came into an understanding of what you know, and you could go over that, and I could go over that with you if I'm aware. Verse 8, and I brought you into the land of the Amorites who dwelt on the other side of the Jordan. And they fought with you, but I gave them into your hand, and you, that you might possess their land, and I destroyed them from before you. So all kinds of things happened, but Israel overcame those various challenges. One of the Moabite king tried to hire out a prophet who had a relationship with God, and what he wanted him to do was to curse the children of Israel. But what happened? God inspired him to bless the children of Israel. Plus we have the very remarkable miracle of the talking donkey that I like to talk about often. But anyway. Verse 9, then Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, arose to make war against Israel and sent and called Balaam, the son of Beor, to curse you. But I would not listen to Balaam, therefore he continued to bless you, so I delivered you out of his hand. Then you went over to the Jordan and came to Jericho, and the men of Jericho fought against you. And then he begins to talk about the tribes which were a part of the Canaanites. So he mentions a few of their names and mentions Canaanites. You know, also the Amorites, the Perizzites, right, the Canaanites. Then he goes on to mention specifically other Canaanites. The Hittites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. But I delivered them into your hand. I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out from before you. This could be literal and metaphoric as well. Various plagues that were natural but yet supernatural that caused havoc and where the Israelites didn't even have to necessarily always fight themselves, that God intervened for them and fought for them. I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out from before you, also the two kings of the Amorites, but not with your sword or with your bow. I have given you a land for which you did not labor and cities which you did not build. So at this time in history, the Canaanites fled, and the Israelites were able to enter the land with fields already cultivated and structures already built. In some cases, now in the case of Jericho, they were to destroy it, but in some cases they were able to occupy the buildings, make use of them, and of course occupy the land and reap the harvest of it and so on. I have given you a land for which you did not labor and cities which you did not build, and you dwell in them and eat of the vineyards. You eat of the vineyards and olive groves which you did not plant. Now therefore fear the Eternal, serve him with sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods from your father, which your father served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Eternal. Forget the Babylonian deities, forget the Egyptian deities, and certainly forget the local deities. Just dump them all, dump them all, forget them. Just serve Yahweh. Be ethical monotheists. One God and the morality which that God requires. Verse 15. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Eternal, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. And this is a very classic statement now from that rings over the centuries that some of you perhaps remember. But as for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. We will serve the Eternal. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. This is what Joshua said, speaking for himself and his immediate family, at least, you know. So the people answered and said, far be it from us that we should forsake the Eternal to serve other gods. This was a wonderful period in their history, similar to the time at Mount Sinai, and for certain very brief periods in their history when they really had a right attitude. It's really refreshing to read this when you read so much negative elsewhere about their behavior. But here they responded positively, and they were blessed for a number of years afterwards. For the Eternal your God is he who brought us and our fathers. I'm sorry, for the Eternal our God is he who brought us and our fathers up out of the land of Egypt. Notice they are saying our God to Joshua. They're all together. For the Eternal our God is he who brought us and our fathers up out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who did those great signs in our sight and preserved us in all the way that we went and among all the people through whom we passed. And the Eternal drove out from before us all the people, including the Amorites who dwelt in the land. We will also serve the Eternal, for he is our God. But you know what? Joshua was not necessarily convinced. And that's the sad part. I guess he, you know, the insight he had, he knew that they were very vulnerable and they really potentially could fall short. So he admonished them here. But Joshua said to the people, you cannot serve the Eternal, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God who will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. So taking on this obligation means you had better live up to it. If you forsake the Eternal and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done you good. And the people said to Joshua, no, but we will serve the Eternal. And indeed they did for at least a period of time, but unfortunately they didn't stick with it. But as you know what the Bible says, Matthew 24:13, he who endures to the end shall be saved. We have to stick with it. Paul said, you know, in 1 Corinthians 9:27, that after preaching to others, he himself did not want to be disqualified. You know, so we need to be consistent and hang in there. You know, as one minister used to say, what is it? How did he used to do it? Hold to the end of the row. That was how he put it. Hold to the end of the row. Luke 9:62, you know, when you put your hand to the plow, you don't look back. You keep on your plowing. Verse 21. And the people said to Joshua, no, but we will serve the Eternal. So Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourselves, that you have chosen the Eternal for yourselves to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. So here around 1380 BC, a renewal of the Sinaitic covenant, a renewal of the commitment on behalf of that nation. And so the community there was in a positive frame of mind and were blessed as a result. Unfortunately, as we know, if we keep reading, It didn't last very long, and over the years, there's been ebbs and flows, and too much negative, unfortunately. Verse 23, "Now therefore," he said, "put away the foreign gods which are among you." So even then, they had their issues then. Some of them were getting involved with paganism even as Joshua was talking to them. I don't mean it right at that moment, but during that period of time, they were flirting with other approaches, wrong approaches. He said, "Let's clear the deck here. Get rid of all this other." "Now therefore," he said, "put away the foreign gods which are among you and incline your heart to the eternal God of Israel." And the people said to Joshua, "Yahweh our God we will serve," right? The Lord our God, the eternal our God we will serve, and his voice we will obey, which is what they told Moses at Sinai around 1447 BC. They made that statement, you know, "Naseh v'nishma," we will do and we will hear. We will do even before we fully understand. We'll do and we'll do more. We'll continue to do. We'll do whatever we hear. We'll do what we hear now. We'll do what we hear later. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. So here we have a renewal of the Sinaitic covenant under Joshua. Then Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone. So evidently there's certain editings of the Torah would seem that Joshua was responsible for. Then Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone, or perhaps he wrote an addendum which became the book of Joshua eventually. That could be what this is talking about, because we do have now the book of Joshua as part of the canon. Probably Samuel had much to do with the fact that we have the book of Joshua and other books that follow. You may recall in Acts 3:24, you don't have to turn there, but there Peter says, "Yes, and all the prophets from Samuel and those who follow, as many as have spoken, have also foretold these days." So Samuel, if you look at Psalm 99, he's one of the prophets, and very likely was responsible for the canonization of the book of Joshua as we have it now. That's just a side technical point, but anyway, let's go back. Verse 26, "Then Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone and set it up there under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the eternal." It would seem that what he's talking about there is that where the people were standing, they had made, in effect, a holy place. This was a special holy convocation, a sort of church service in our sense, an ecclesiastical gathering. And so the stone was placed next to where they were gathered. I don't think it necessarily refers to a building or altar so much as perhaps just the fact that that's where the people were, and that place was therefore a sanctuary. But that's speculation on my part. "And Joshua said to all the people, behold, the stone shall be a witness to us, for it has heard all the words of the Eternal which he spoke to us. It shall therefore be a witness to you, lest you deny your God." Now, evidently, at some point in history, that stone was removed. Perhaps, you know, in all the conflict and migrations and various things that happened, somebody perhaps thought of it as some kind of special holy object that ought to be perhaps taken with them. And perhaps that's what happened. Probably some group decided we need to appropriate this holy object, and perhaps they took it and hauled it over somewhere. I don't think it's there anymore. But it would have been there for at least a period of time, and just as certain monuments are around today that in every country, you know, we visit the monuments and we remember what they picture, that monument would have been there to help the Israelites remember. Verse 28. "So Joshua let the people depart, each to his own inheritance." So he'd said what he needed to say. They had done what they needed to do. "Now it came to pass after these things that Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Eternal, died, being 110 years old. But he had certainly finished the course, as Paul talked about himself, you know, that now I'm waiting for the crown that awaits me, you know, there in 2 Timothy. So he had finished the job. He'd done what Moses commissioned him to do, what God commissioned him to do. So he dies at 110. And verse 30, "And they buried him within the border of the inheritance of Timnath-Serah, which is in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaash." Moses was from the tribe of Levi. Joshua was from the birthright tribe, the tribe of Ephraim, descendant of Joseph. "Israel served the Eternal all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua." So that's the encouraging news, encouraging history. There was a positive period that we can look back on with satisfaction. "Who had known all the works of the Eternal which he had done for Israel." Now, the sad part is it didn't go beyond that generation. If you read the book of Judges, you'll see that at some point it began to peter out and then get really bad. It really began to deteriorate dramatically, as you can keep reading. Anyway, verse 32. The bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought up out of Egypt, they buried in Shechem, and the plot of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and which had become an inheritance of the children of Joseph. So you see the roots of the people of Israel go way, way back, you know, in that land. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died. So we have a priest here who played an important role spiritually in the lives of those people. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died. They buried him in a hill belonging to Phinehas, his son. Phinehas, a very zealous priest. You heard about him in the book of Numbers. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died. They buried him in a hill belonging to Phinehas, his son, which was given to him in the mountains of Ephraim. So here we have the conclusion of a generation. And we have Joshua, we have his farewell address, and we have the solemn commitment that he caused Israel to make to be faithful to the covenant that they had made. Now that was the old covenant, but it was a covenant between a nation and God, and that nation was to be then the example to other nations. And they had made the commitment to keep that covenant. Now because they did not, but unfortunately failed miserably, therefore, the catastrophes came upon them that they will be commemorating in the next few days. Now, what does that have to do with us? What, you know, Joshua's legacy have to do with us? Well, you know, Joshua is also the name of our Savior. And there, our Savior, Joshua, brought a new covenant. And he created a community which, in effect, is, as you know, a spiritual Israel, spiritual Jews. You could look at the book of Galatians. You could look at the book of Romans. All of us who are part of the new covenant are spiritually Hebrews, spiritually descendants of Abraham and Sarah. And we inherit the promises. We ultimately will inherit the earth and the universe, if you look at the book of Hebrews. But we have to be faithful to that covenant. We have to remember Joshua's legacy. He warned the people, if you're faithful, all these blessings will come upon you and more. If you are unfaithful, then of course there's a price that has to be paid that you certainly don't want to pay. You'd rather not. I want to go to finish then to what Paul wrote in the book of 2 Thessalonians, writing to a Greek-speaking church in Thessalonica, the city of Salonica in modern Greece. Paul wrote 2 Thessalonians. He wrote two letters to them. I'm quoting from the second one. And this is really part of Joshua's legacy, but now it becomes Paul's legacy. So what Paul told his people in 2 Thessalonians is what I'm telling all of you who are listening to me. We have now a canon. We have Holy Scriptures. We have the Old Testament and the New Testament. We have the writings of the apostles. We have apostolic instruction. And we need to remain faithful and consistent with that apostolic instruction. Faithful to that instruction, consistent with it. We need to keep our covenant, the new covenant that we have with God through Jesus Christ and, you know, through the Holy Spirit that we have residing in us if we have had that conversion process. So I want to go to 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter and verse 15. So knowing what we know about the history of Israel, the history of the church, our own personal history, and knowing what we know about the future, 2 Thessalonians 2:15, we therefore must be faithful to the apostolic instruction. Therefore, brethren, Paul writes, 2 Thessalonians 2:15, stand fast. This is what Joshua said, right? Hold fast. Hold on. Hang on. Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, not the ones you've concocted or that your ancestors concocted, but the ones that are grounded in this word, the ones that we have taught you, the apostolic traditions. Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or our epistle. Now, we haven't had the experience of face-to-face confrontations with the apostles, but we do have their letters. We do have the epistles of Paul and the other material. We have the Holy Scriptures. So, therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or our epistle, Paul says. This is Paul's legacy. This is Joshua's legacy. I'd like to share some positive news with those who are listening. It's come to my attention that we have listeners in Italy, and I'm very thrilled to know that, and listeners in the Portuguese-speaking world, Brazil and Portugal, particularly, evidently, we do have a significant number of listeners in Brazil. So, as I said, I'm quite excited about that. And, you know, the more the merrier. I hope that this message goes out more and more around the world. Also, I have news about John Halford. He is cancer-free. His surgery evidently was successful. And so now we want to pray about his complete recovery, as now he's in the recovery phase. But we can be grateful that to God that now John Halford is cancer-free and in the recovery stages. I have now some news about my sister-in-law, Betty Martin. This is an up-to-date memo, evidently. Betty has been moved to Baylor Rehab in room 315, Baylor Rehab in the Dallas area, room 315. She will be there a few weeks. She's making rapid progress in recovering from her stroke, but could use plenty of encouragement. Please note that she may not always be able to answer the phone with up to 4 hours of rehab each day. So Betty Martin is improving, and we can be grateful for that. I'd also like you to remember, please, the family of Harry Snyder. Many of you know him. Harry died recently, so his family certainly needs your prayers. And we've had another death in the community, Cindy Curley. Many of you know that family. And her mother, Marilyn DeVry, is still alive. And, of course, her husband, Harry, is known to many of you. So please keep those families in mind, Harry Curley and the DeVry family and also the Snyder family. And then there are some others who are battling illness that there's one other person, and his first name, I think his name, last name was Dietrich. Was it Larry Dietrich? But he was a pilot. Some of you remember him as a pilot who served the church for many years. I believe his wife has died, so keep that family in mind as well, please. And now, regarding those who are battling illness, I want us to remember Mike Rasmussen. That's, again, somebody that many of you know, and Mac Overton. These are two men that many of you know who are listening to me. I realize for some of you, you don't know who they are, but you can still pray for them because I've mentioned them, and now you're aware of their needs, that they both have cancer and could certainly use our prayers. And then one other name, and this is a name that perhaps is a little more famous to all of you. You may remember, you know, D-Bar Pardian, who isn't with us now, but his daughter-in-law, Renee, his son is Danny Pardian, of course, and Renee, they've been married for quite some time, and Renee now is battling cancer, Renee Pardian. And as I said, many of you would know that family, and many of you would know Renee. So please keep these people in mind in your prayers, those who need comfort because of the lost loved ones, or those who are battling cancer at this time, Mike Rasmussen and Mac Overton and Renee Aparti. And thank you so much for your prayers for Betty Martin and John Halford, who are evidently recovering, and, you know, we're very grateful for that. And we certainly appreciate when you communicate with us. You know, you could email us. We have a Facebook page. We'll try to send you out. We'll try to have more information about the coming autumn festivals very soon. I was asked recently about that, so we'll try to have more information coming up very soon about the autumn festival, which we hope to host here. And then we hope to be in the spring out in Southern California, but that's a long way off. Let's think about for the moment the autumn festivals, which we hope to host right here in Central Florida. So in the meantime, you know, we still have half the summer to go before the autumn festivals are on us, but they're not really that far away. It's really only about, you know, 2 months or so to the beginning of the Festival of Trumpets. But between now and then, all the best to you and yours.
You're fine.
Okay. Have you been keeping up on Israeli music?